Their apparent objective is to crush resistance, paralyze communication, and disorganize human society.
People trust media. Whether it's the panic or whether it's the myth of the panic, whatever it is that people wanted to believe, if there was a media there ready to instate those beliefs, they were going to get believed.
Yeah.
And if something is presented as news, a lot of times people will believe what they see on the news over what they see with their own eyes. They'll hear about bodies being piled up, and they'll look outside and they won't see anything that looks even remotely close to it, but the news told them, so they've got to be afraid of it.
Yeah.
They'll hear about threats from this color of person or threats from that color of person, and they know people of that same color or those same religions, and they're nothing like what their news presents them, but they believe their news over their own senses. It's that whole, who are you going to believe, me or your own lying eyes? A lot of times, if me is the media, people are going to believe the media. And so my disclaimer, as always, I don't work with the way I wish people were. I don't work with the way I wish the world was. My job is not to live in the world of I wish. My job is to live in the world of how things are and work with that. This is how people are. And so as a business owner, as a marketer, don't ignore the power that media has over people. Don't ignore the power that things presented as news, things presented as content can have over people.
The day that I was born, and that man of mine I've ever seen.
Pops make a hit with every member of the family at the breakfast table. He's lazy, said the father. He's a dull boy, said his teacher. And little Jimmy Carter was demoted a grade. But neither was right. A child specialist found that Jimmy was a normal boy. This child needs balanced nourishment, not a private tutor, was his verdict. So Jimmy's mother balanced his diet, and the boy speedily became a...
thing. My baby don't tell who knows.
Bowls of flowers, bouquets of flowers, pillars of flowers, flowers in the shape of the American flag, in the shape of hearts, in the shape of harps also.
Now here's another bulletin from Washington, D.C. The office of the director of the National Red Cross reports 10 units of Red Cross emergency workers have been assigned to the headquarters of the state militia, stationed outside of Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Here's a bulletin from State Police, Princeton Junction. The fires at Grover's Mill and vicinity are now under control. Scouts report all quiet in the pit, and there is no sign of life appearing from the mouth of the cylinder. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have a special statement from Mr. Harry McDonald, Vice President in charge of operations.
We have received a request from the state militia of Trenton to place at their disposal our entire broadcasting facilities. In view of the gravity of the situation, and believing that radio has a responsibility to serve in the public interest at all times, we are turning over our facilities to the state militia at Trenton.
We take you now to the field headquarters of the state militia near Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
This is Captain Lansing of the Signal Corps attached to the state militia, now engaged in military operations in the vicinity of Grover's Mill. Situation arising from the reported presence of certain individuals of unidentified nature is now under complete control. The cylindrical object, which lies in a pit directly below our position, surrounded on all sides by 8 battalions of infantry, without heavy field pieces, but adequately armed with rifles and machine guns. All cause for alarm, if such cause ever existed, is now entirely unjustified. The things, whatever they are, do not even venture to poke their heads above the pit. I can see their hiding place plainly in the glare of the searchlights here. With all their reported resources, these creatures can scarcely stand up against heavy machine gun fire. Anyway, it's an interesting outing for the troops. I can make out their khaki uniforms, crossing back and forth in front of the lights. Looks almost like a real war. There appears to be some slight smoke in the woods bordering the Millstone River, probably fire started by campers. Well, we ought to see some action soon. One of the companies is deploying on the left flank. A quick thrust and it'll all be over. Now, wait a minute, I see something on top of the cylinder. No, it's nothing but a shadow. Now the troops are on the edge of the Wilmot Farm. 7,000 armed men closing in on an old metal tube. A tub, rather. Well, wait, that wasn't a shadow. It's something moving. Solid metal, kind of a shield-like affair rising up out of the cylinder. It's going higher and higher. What? It's standing on legs, actually rearing up on a sort of metal framework. Now it's reaching above the trees and the searchlights are on it. Hold on.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from the planet Mars. The battle which took place tonight at Grover Mills has ended in one of the most startling defeats ever suffered by an army in modern times. 7,000 men armed with rifles and machine guns pitted against a single fighting machine of the invaders from Mars. 120 known survivors. The rest strewn over the battle area from Grover's Mill to Plainsboro, crushed and trampled to death under the metal feet of the monster, or burned to cinders by its heat ray. The monster is now in control of the middle section of New Jersey and has effectively cut the state through its center. Communication lines are down from Pennsylvania to the Atlantic Ocean. Railroad tracks are torn and service from New York to Philadelphia discontinued, except routing some of the trains through Allerton and Phoenixville. Highways to the north, south, and west are clogged with frantic human traffic. Police and army reserves are unable to control the mad flight. By morning, the fugitives will have swelled Philadelphia, Camden, and Trenton, it is estimated, to twice their normal population. Martial law prevails throughout New Jersey and eastern Pennsylvania. At this time, we take you to Washington for a special broadcast on the national emergency. The Secretary of the Interior.
Citizens of the nation, I shall not try to conceal the gravity of the situation that confronts the country, nor the concern of your government in protecting the lives and property of its people. However, I wish to impress upon you, private citizens and public officials, all of you, the urgent need of calm and resourceful action. Fortunately, this formidable enemy is still confined to a comparatively small area, and we may place our faith in the military forces to keep them there. In the meantime, placing our faith in God, we must continue the performance of our duties, each and every one of us, so that we may confront this destructive adversary with a nation united, courageous, and consecrated to the preservation of human supremacy on this earth. I thank you.
You have just heard the Secretary of the Interior speaking from Washington. Bulletins too numerous to read are piling up in the studio here. We're informed that the central portion of New Jersey is blacked out from radio communication due to the effect of the heat ray upon power lines and electrical equipment. Here's a special bulletin in New York. Cables have been received from English, French, and German scientific bodies offering assistance. Astronomers report continued gas outbursts at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The majority voiced the opinion that the enemy will be reinforced by additional rocket machines. There have been several attempts made to locate Professor Pearson of Princeton, who has observed Martians at close range. It is feared he was lost in the recent battle. Langham Field, Virginia. Scouting planes report three Martian machines visible above treetops, moving north toward Somerville with population fleeing ahead of them. The heat ray is not in use, although advancing at express train speed, invaders pick their way carefully. They seem to be making a conscious effort to avoid destruction of cities and countryside. However, they stop to uproot power lines, bridges, and railroad tracks. Their apparent objective is to crush resistance, paralyze communication, and disorganize human society.
We gon' make this shit happen right here, right now. Calling out to all area group. We gon' make this shit happen right here, right now. Calling out to all area group. We gon' make this shit happen right here, right now. I wanna welcome y'all to house of who the hell he is. And it's cool that y'all can make it to my new meeting. So take your time, grab a table, we got booths seating. That will now be introduced me to my new people. See, my name is Lyrics Born, baby, and I truly mean it. From the past, from the future, from the new and recent. You don't believe it, you can read it, page one.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Today's Monday, November 2nd. What a week. And this is the third installment of Emotional Manipulators for Hire, a theoretically subscriber-only production that I do with my friend Nathan Frazier of the Dark Arts of Marketing podcast and the Free Market Squad. Check the show notes for links to Nathan's work. And I understand that this being episode 3, I have failed over 66% of the time in making its release exclusive to School Sucks supporting listeners. We've done 3. I put 2 out as podcasts if you are checking my work at home with a calculator. Nathan and I talked about this and we came to the same conclusion. It's just like, geez, sometimes these are just going to have to be for everybody. If you want access to part 2, and trust me, many future episodes in this series, you need to go to schoolsucksproject.com/AV. Look at our support options, pick one, and sign up to support us. The most expedient and friction-free way to get access to our supporter-only content is to go to patreon.com/schoolsucks. All right, thanks for listening. Take care, and please be safe out there. I was happy just listening. So when we started talking about the topic for this show, I was like, how are we going to put a positive spin on this? How are we going to use this story or the tactics in this story for good? Nathan has a way, and we'll get to that. But the first thing I wanted to do is just talk about what this topic is and why you were attracted to it.
For the people that don't know, this is not a live broadcast. We are recording this a couple of days in advance of Halloween. And I figured, just because as Halloween is approaching while we're recording this, it would be fun to go and revisit one of those popular cult classics of conspiracy theory world and Halloween. And that is the Orson Welles' broadcast of War of the Worlds. And I thought it'd just be fun because there's some marketing lessons in there. There's some human psychology lessons in there. And there's some stuff to be debated. So I figured we would have an enjoyable conversation about it.
Right. Well, I love the idea. H.G. Wells, the author of this book, I think this book was written in right at the turn of the 20th century. He was an interesting character. He was a Fabian socialist. Orson Welles was a very interesting character himself. And this event that took place one day short of 82 years ago exactly, October 30th, 1938, definitely became part of American folklore, I would say. I remember hearing about this story when I was a little kid. This man went on the radio and caused all this panic. But it's a little bit more complicated than that.
It is. And I heard the same story. It's kind of like one of those urban legends, especially when we were growing up. We didn't have the internet to, quote unquote, fact check everything. But I heard the same thing. I heard he gets on the radio. He starts talking about an alien invasion and everybody believes it and the world loses its shit and people start protesting. I mean, mostly peaceful rioting and burning stuff down and everybody flips out. There's questions about that. I'm sure we'll probably get into that. But yeah, and it was, especially when I first started getting into the conspiracy theory stuff when the internet first came around, to find out the backgrounds of H.G. Wells and the backgrounds of Orson Welles, and then hear the stories about, oh, the government found out that they could use the media to make people freak out over something that wasn't even happening. And when you look around, it feels like they do have that power. Mm-hmm. So it was very easy for me to accept that. But yeah, there's points to go against that argument as well.
So it's funny because I started doing research about the actual event itself. There's a lot I didn't know about it. And it made me recall this question that I had been having in recent years about a conspiracy theory that has become very popular, like alarmingly popular, and it's called Flat Earth. My question about the Flat Earth conspiracy is if it was a kind of trial balloon, right? To see like what levers could be pulled and wires and dials could be adjusted in the technology that people are using to communicate, or they think they're using to communicate and get information to make a sizable amount of people, certainly not a majority of people or even like a dangerous percent of people, believe that the Earth is actually flat. But the amount of traction that this story got just in the last 2 or 3 years seemed like it was some kind of test to me. There was no other way that I could explain it than as a test or a trial balloon of some disinformation campaign to see how successful they could be with something completely preposterous. And this kind of calls back to that, because for those who are unfamiliar with the story of War of the Worlds, again, science fiction book written at the end of the 19th century, H.G. Wells sets it up as this alien invasion from the planet Mars. Now, of course, they knew nothing compared to what they know today about Mars at that time. So this was probably a much scarier prospect, certainly in the 19th century. But even to a certain extent, I think for most people in 1938, when this happened. So it kind of reminded me of that. It kind of reminded me, like, if the conspiracy angle has some truth to it, as far as like what media can force people to think and then ultimately do, seem to have a little bit of a flat. The aliens from Mars in 1938 seem to have a bit of a tie into flat Earth in, I think that it really caught traction in 2018.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, with more knowledge, you would hope that it'd be harder, more difficult to pull the wool over the eyes of entire swaths of society, but
it's so much easier.
I mean, yeah, I mean, going through what we're going through right now, it seems like it's on both extremes. Like when you look at the QAnon, the virus is a hoax, people. Mm-hmm. And then when you look at the hardcore, the virus is the most dangerous thing we've ever experienced, people. Like on both ends, it seems like it's pretty easy to get people to believe some pretty preposterous things even today.
And to protect those beliefs by the echo chambers they live in. Right? To protect, once they believe something, to make it basically impermeable as far as new information is concerned. So if people hear this at some point way off in the future, right now we're like less than a week away from a presidential election. And the big news, or not news at all, depending on who you are and what your vantage point is the Hunter Biden laptop scandal. And I've been trying to say to people who are just like so pissed about this being censored and other people not looking into it, there's no such thing as an October surprise anymore. An October surprise used to be like something that could happen right before the election and sway a bunch of people to go the other way. That's what this Hunter Biden thing is supposed to be. But in order for a thing to be surprising, I think it has to be acknowledged. And there's lots of people who will just take the thinnest, flimsiest explanation of, oh, it's Russian disinformation, and then they never have to look at it again. This technology, I think, has made it easier than ever. It's just like, yeah, when we were kids, adults could just tell us anything and we had no way to fact check them. So I remember saying, like, certainly when I started my show, this is the dawn of a golden age, this information age. And now wait till you see what kids are going to be able to do. Sorry I said that. It hasn't bared itself out that way. So now is a more challenging time than ever to convey new or disruptive information to people who've already decided what they want to believe. And that's going to factor into this story as well, even back then.
Yeah. So since we're kind of on the subject, I want to talk about just what media is, whether it's social media, whether it's mainstream media, just the concept of media, and kind of explore the origins of the word media, if you don't mind.
Yeah, please.
So the origins of the word, the root of media is med or med, and that's kind of like a middle, the go-between. So you've got medicine, which is the go-between or the bridge between sickness and health, if it's not a perverted industry like it is. You've got medium, which is like in between hot or cold, or the bridge between the living and the dead. We've got media, which is supposed to be the bridge between what you currently understand and what you're meant to understand. So there's you, there's your little bubble, and then there's this big world out there. And the media is supposed to be the bridge between you and your small, secluded world and the big world out there, if it was doing its job. It's not really that way. And social media and mainstream media, we've talked about this in previous episodes, now they act more as a way to secure that small little understanding of the world and prevent anything from coming in. And media doesn't hold all the blame. That's kind of what we as human beings do. We say, this is what I want to believe, and anything that might threaten that, I'm going to put up this bubble of protection to stop me from hearing countering ideas. And media has just learned that in order to keep the money coming in, their algorithms or their programming schedule should match that and help us do that. So I don't want to put all the blame on media, but ideally what media should do is be the bridge between what we understand and what we need to understand. And that'll play a role later on in the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Things that I've been trying to enter into the conversation on my show, this has been a lot of our university discussions lately, just on like media literacy and intellectual self-defense. The first is the work of Matt Taibbi. He might have actually even come up in our last show. Matt Taibbi is an investigative journalist. He's definitely more oriented towards the left. And he has this new book called Hate Incorporated, and he talks about how the media's model has changed over the last 20 or so years, most of them following the formula of like Fox News, where it's like the news used to be, you know, you talk to everybody, there's an agreed upon language, and what actually makes more sense as a business model is to niche it down and only talk to a specific group of people, which makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, this came up in our tribalism show. As a business model, it makes a lot of sense. And social media has certainly followed that using, you know, its algorithms to do anything to, above all, create engagement. So sometimes it will show you something out of your silo if you're disengaged. This is something we've been talking about, too. Like, if you won't engage the way your friends are engaging in, like, social and political issues, it will feed you something in the hopes of getting you angry. But that's still from your vantage point in the silo or the echo chamber that you're in. So those are two aspects of this. Like, I really encourage people to check out Taibbi's, at least his talk. You can just YouTube Hate Incorporated and you can find it. And, you know, there's also this new movie that has a lot of intrigue around it. I don't know if you've seen it yet. The Social Dilemma.
I have not seen it yet. I'm familiar with what it's about, though.
It's from a lot of like Silicon Valley insiders who are supposedly like blowing the whistle, but it might just have a bit of this like Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, this is why Trump is the president kind of angle, while neglecting how these things are actually affecting everybody, which is no good as far as I'm concerned. If the movie comes out, like if you watch the trailer for the movie, everything in the trailer is about like Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, right? So they don't even mention Twitter in the trailer, I don't think. So this fake world that has been created by these platforms for people to live in, from that fake world, they might see the social dilemma and not see it as like, oh, yeah, this is really a good opportunity for me to self-reflect about my information diet. They'd go, aha, I knew those idiots who voted for Trump. They don't know how lost they are. But it really applies to everybody. So I'm encouraged that such a documentary is on Netflix, and I hope at least it's a conversation starter about this issue. But while you were talking about media, I wanted to provide a little bit of historical context here as well, because whenever a new medium arrives, there's a lot of like public distrust around it. Like they said this in the 19th century about novels, like this is going to ruin kids' lives. They're just going to sit around and read these, you know, fantasies and these fictions all the time. Obviously, it was true about television. It was true about film. There were a lot of like guardians of goodness, lots of efforts, some of them led by Thomas Edison early on in the 20th century around film censorship. Of course, we have the Hays Code that lasted until the 1960s, the rating system for film that followed that. Always people trying to prevent what was getting out of the public behind this idea of having standards. And radio was no different. In 1938, when this broadcast ran, radio was less than 20 years old, right? And AM broadcasting was probably less than 15 years old, right? So as a Red Sox fan, I grew up a Red Sox fan, and until 2004, they hadn't won the World Series since 1918. So there was no audio or video record of announcers calling a World Series win for the Red Sox, right? Because AM radio did not exist then. And it didn't even gain traction until, like I said, 10 or 15 years before Orson Welles' broadcast of War of the Worlds. So it was still a fairly new medium, and it was able to do things that the other medium for news, newspapers, was not able to do, right? Which is breaking news or special bulletins. They could beat newspapers to the punch. And this is also happening in 1938, which in the United States is a fairly tense time. The U.S. has escalating problems with Japan. It's the end of the Great Depression. There is the rise of Nazism. Hitler hasn't invaded Poland yet, but there's the rise of Nazism in Central Europe. So, and then, of course, the Hindenburg disaster, which was called or announced on radio. There was somebody basically doing the play-by-play of the Hindenburg landing in 1937, and you get that, oh, the humanity thing. And in fact, Welles sent the actors who were playing news reporters in the adaptation of War of the Worlds for the radios, he sent them to the archives to hear those broadcasts of the Hindenburg so they could strike the right tone in this presentation of War of the Worlds. So that's the setting of this broadcast in 1938.
Yeah, and the way that it's presented, it's on radio. There's no fast forward. There's no, you know, digital skip to the beginning and start over like we have now. So if you come in 2 minutes after the beginning, you don't get the 3-second introduction telling you that this is a performance. And the way that it's presented, the way that it goes, it sounds like it's a broadcast of classical music, and then it gets interrupted with breaking news. Oh, we've got this weird thing happening on Mars. We don't know what it is. We're going to try and figure it out. Now back to your regularly scheduled program. And then it goes back to the classical music. And then a couple minutes later, here's Professor so-and-so talking about these explosions. He says there's nothing to worry about. It doesn't sound like it's a play. It sounds like it's a broadcast of music, and it's being interrupted with news segments. And they play that. They stick to that bit up until about 37 minutes into it. And then that's the first time, other than the very beginning, that something lets you know, oh, this is actually a program. This is this is people play acting. But up until then, it sounds like a classical music broadcast interrupted by news segments. And the first time that they, other than the very beginning, if you tuned in a couple of minutes after it started, the first time that you hear anything about it being actors is when they get to the point of the program where it no longer sounds like the first half hour, first 35 minutes sounds like a music production with breaking news breaking in every once in a while. And then it goes to a first person narrative of the guy talking about, and then I did this, and then I went to this building, and I wrote this down in my diary. At that point, you can say, oh, this is obviously a reenactment or a play or something like that. But up until that point where the shift happens in the tone of how it's being presented, that entire 35 minute segment where it sounds like an actual radio broadcast with news interruptions breaking in, that whole time, they don't stop to tell you. There's no commercial breaks. There's no, hey, this is a reenactment. There's nothing like that up until the point where the listener would naturally say, oh, okay, I get it.
Okay, so there's an interesting comment here as to how a skilled theater person learns to build the emotional investment of an audience in something, right? Using the medium that he has available, but understanding the emotions of the people that make up the audience. So we're talking about Orson Welles. This was really the thing that put him on the map, which is why a lot of people say that he actually really enjoyed the panicked response or the story about the panicked response that this broadcast got. But this Mercury Radio Theater that hosted, I think it was CBS Radio, that hosted War of the Worlds, it wasn't their first go at doing this. They had actually tried to do a radio dramatization of Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula, and I think Welles felt like it fell a little bit flat. So he spent more time strategizing about how to hook people into this. I think he was a smart enough guy to understand the possible danger, but that's just what I mean, I can't remove myself from being able to look back at it from here. And also the myth that's been fed to me about this thing my whole life, it's hard to extract that all from an analysis, but it's hard to imagine that he couldn't have foreseen this response from people in the audience. But I think as far as like, what lessons can you take out of this and use for good? This was a theater person's revising of not just a format, but of the content itself to build the maximal emotional investment, which you got to give it to him. He did do that, at least in those first 37 minutes, with the way he set this thing up. So he put a lot of thought into that.
Yeah. And one of the things, too, to keep in mind, and this also works in advertising, it was presented as entertainment and it was presented as news. So that lowers the defense of people listening. Just like when an advertisement is in a magazine and it looks like a news article, and the only way you can tell it's an advertisement is the very fine print at the very bottom that says, this is an advertisement. But otherwise, it looks like one of the other articles that would be in the magazine or in the news now. They have the same thing where if you're a marketer, you can be like, oh, okay, this was an advertisement for my pillow. But if you're not a marketer, you're like, oh man, that was a very informative news segment about this new pillow. And I'm intrigued. I want to go check it out.
Right, right.
Presenting it as content, presenting it as entertainment, and then presenting it as having spliced in interjections of news helps lower the defenses of people. So it gets them out of that skeptical, I'm hearing something on the radio, I need to listen to it with a sense of disbelief. It helps alleviate that. And so I can't imagine that he just did that on accident. I think the way that, at least from a marketer's point of view, the way that I look at it, and also a little bit from the conspiracy theory point of view, it's hard for me to believe he didn't intentionally lay it out that way.
Yeah, I think that that's possible. It makes me want to kind of shift just directions really quickly, and then we'll come right back to the attributes that made this work. But in terms of like the content that we create, right? You know, I have people on my show all the time. I just had our mutual friend Landon on all the time who have something to promote. I'm not taking money from them. They're not like paid spots for these people to be there because I think they genuinely have something to say that my audience will benefit from. And I'm always making a clear distinction, like this is an affiliate. We have a partnership with these people. I mention like Praxis in almost every show. I've never gotten any money from them, nor have I asked, right? Because it's something that I really believe in. But everybody who comes on my show, almost everybody, I would say, has something to promote or has something they want to point my audience to. So this is clearly positioned as what I think it is, not news, but something you can use, right? So when we're trying to take a lesson out of that to use positively, do you have any comment on just the most like authentic and sincere way to do it other than just like, hey, this is about money. You know, you get more content if you pay us. This is an affiliate. This is a partnership versus this is just somebody who's here, you know, partially for their self-interest because they have something to promote. But and that's kind of like how that's the deal. That's the exchange for their time is they get to promote a thing. But to do it in a way that's like sincere, so people don't feel burned by it.
Yeah. So I think that a lot of times, especially when I'm listening to your show and your guests that come on, I don't think it has to be an either or thing. I think it can be a natural blend. It can be a, hey, we want to have a fun conversation, an inspiring conversation, an educational conversation. I think it should include one of those three things. It should be educational, entertaining, or inspiring. But also, hey, if you want to check out more, if you enjoyed this, you might enjoy some of the other stuff that I have to offer. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with doing that. In fact, personally, I think that's the best way to promote and market things because you give people value up front. You give people a reason to believe you. You give people something before you ever ask of them. And a lot of times when it comes to the way that you do things and the way that your guests do things, it's, hey, I'm going to give you a bunch of stuff, whether it's going to be an entertaining thing, whether it's going to be an informational or an educational, whatever it's going to be, I'm just going to give it to you. I'm going to give you an hour and a half of this. And if you enjoyed it, there's no obligation, but you can go check out more. And if you want to go a little bit further into my world, this is how you do it. But if you don't want to go further into my world, if you just want to enjoy this free conversation, get what you can get out of it as well. I don't think that there's anything wrong with that at all.
Right. So you talk about like what Wells did here as a way of lowering defenses, right? Something that you can use in marketing something. But I think a really good way to lower people's defenses is to build a relationship with them. To build know, like, and trust. And then they don't have to. I mean, it doesn't mean like, yes, and once you do this, you totally take advantage of them. It means know, like, and trust are real things. And when you build them, people don't feel like they need to defend themselves against you like you're a stranger or a hack. I don't know if you've ever gotten email requests to do like paid interviews. Like, people will reach out to me. And they'll say, we'll pay you to interview this person and you can ask, you know, you have to talk about this and then you can ask whatever other questions you want. Well, obviously, if I did that, I've never done it. I've thought about it. Especially when I saw what some of them were willing to pay. I've thought about doing it. And I would have to say at the beginning of the show, like, this is a paid, but how does that, I never figured out a way to set that up as like, hey, but I still want you to take this completely seriously. It just feels like I'm breaking the entire routine of what I do. So I've never done it.
Yeah, I have gotten those messages before. I've taken the same position as you. Number one, I think truth in advertising, you probably should let your listeners know that this is a paid promotion.
Oh, I feel like you'd have to. I couldn't imagine trying to pursue something like that without doing that.
Here's just a kind of a side tangent. When you first start getting into, or at least back in the day when I first started getting into alternative media, there's a lot of that that goes on. There's a lot of like these AM radio stations that have things like Alex Jones, and they have the local version of Alex Jones that does a 2-hour show. And the way that those radio stations stay in business is they have 2-hour shows talking about how all the different economic collapses that are about to come, and you need to get in gold and silver. And the show is actually ran by and put on by people that run a gold and silver company, or it's a story about how to, it's a 2-hour broadcast about alternative health and how the pharmaceutical companies are poisoning you and the food companies are poisoning you. And there's this new hyaluronic acid that they've discovered from fish in Japan. And that's why Japanese people look younger, and you can actually get the same stuff without having to go to Japan. And it only costs $29.99. And just for being our listener today, we're going to give you your first month free. There's a lot of that. And I don't have a problem with it as long as you actually believe in what you're selling and it actually helps the people. But at the same time, you build that know, like, and trust. And let's just be honest about it. It is to lower the defenses of people. Now, that doesn't mean that you're trying to come in with a Trojan horse and sell them something that's bad for them or sell them on your agenda. But sometimes it does mean that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're trying to identify some of the, replicatable aspects or attributes of Wells's approach to War of the Worlds. So that first one is positioning. Another one is basically building trust and rapport. How do you think he does that or the whole presentation does that in War of the Worlds?
I think that there's two ways that he does it. First of all, people are skeptical. People might be curious about what's going on Mars, but most people don't believe that there's life on Mars. And the very first person that comes on is Professor Pearson. And he says, no, there's no life on Mars. Mm. This is obviously just some kind of weird eruptions that are happening on the planet. We don't know what it is, but definitely not life on Mars. Now, if you're somebody back in the 30s and you're listening to the news, that's what you would expect. If they came on and they said, we just saw these eruptions and we think that aliens are coming, you would immediately put up your red flags. Your defenses would go up and you'd be like, okay, something screwy going on here.
Yeah.
But if they have this professor come on and he says, it's probably nothing. We wanted to let you know, but it's probably nothing. Then you're like, oh, okay, that's what I was at. That's what I would naturally believe. It's probably nothing, but there is something going on. This guy, he's an expert. He comes on and he tells me exactly what I would already believe. And now he's more agreeable. Just like today, when you turn on the news, you turn on the news that tells you what you already believe. If you believe that Trump is a fascist, you're going to turn on MSNBC. If you believe that Trump is a patriot trying to save the country, you're going to turn on Fox News. You automatically like and trust people who tell you. It's the old saying, people like us like us. Mm-hmm. So you're going to like people that are like you. You're going to like people that reinforce what you already believe. And that's what the very first news, breaking news that interrupts the program is a professor coming in and telling the audience what they want to hear. And then the way that they do it, they go a little bit further. The next interruption is at the farmhouse where they had this crash, something crashed from the sky, and they're interviewing some of the people and they interview people just like you. It's a farmer that owns a little bit of property and has a little farmhouse. It's a spectator that was driving by and saw something crash. So now that they're moving you from what you believe about the world and they're slowly moving you into what they want you to believe about the world, they're going to use people who are just like you. And that's a great thing for like testimonials. Use testimonials of people who are just like your market, who are struggling with the things that your market is struggling with, who use your product or service to get what they wanted. That way, when they read those testimonials, they're like, oh, this person's just like me. And they've done something that I didn't believe that I could do. But now that I've seen them, someone who's just like me, accomplish this, I believe that I also can accomplish this. So by starting out where the mindset of the listener was at and slowly using people who look just like the listener to bring them to where they want them to be, it's a great marketing lesson right there. It's also something that you have to watch out for in the media, because a lot of times the media, they've been caught dressing up their own cameraman and being like, oh, I was standing there and then the planes came into the building and then this and this, and we were running for our lives. And then it was like they came down just one by one, like a pancake effect. And it was obviously because of the jet fuel. And then you find out, oh, this guy who looks just like me, who's saying it was obviously because of the jet fuel, he's actually a CNN cameraman that they dressed up to look like just a random bypasser.
Okay, so I want to pause on that, because this is a very curious video where it was Fox, by the way. I'm pretty sure it was Fox. During the late afternoon on September 11th, this very enthusiastic dude gets in front of a camera and a microphone, as if like what Nathan is describing, and he literally lays out, I'm not trying to sound crazy, but he literally lays out what becomes the official story of 9/11 as far as the building collapse is concerned. Now, it was found out, and I think they did even acknowledge later that day that he was a guy that worked for Fox. So how much of this, how nefarious this actually is, it could just be as innocent, even though it's not innocent, as like, we need an eyewitness to put in front of the camera right now. Go get Steve or Mark. His name might have been Mark, but I can't. Last time I looked for this video, I couldn't find it. And in fact, if you start, we were talking about this on my show recently. If you go to YouTube right now and you put in like 9/11 truth or something like that, you're going to be pretty disappointed with the results. It's the landscape has changed quite a bit as far as like what you can easily find on YouTube. So I haven't been able to track down that video, but I attest to what Nathan is saying. It is real. Mark or Steve gives this very clearly, like when you look back at it, you might not have seen it in all of the panic of that day, but when you go back and you watch this, it is incredibly contrived, this performance.
You live just a few blocks away and witnessed.
Dude, I live on the 43rd floor of a building, which is five blocks from the World Trade Center itself. I witnessed the entire thing from beginning to end.
People talk about how it looked like a movie. I know when I came walking down here early this morning and saw both towers on fire and people on every street corner, it was like a movie, but you watched the planes hit the towers.
I was watching with my roommate. It was approximately several minutes after the first plane had hit. I saw this plane come out of nowhere and just ream right into the side of the Twin Tower, exploding through the other side. And then I witnessed both towers collapse, one first and then the second, mostly due to structural failure because the fire was just too intense.
And some more recent and accessible examples as far as like things you could find on YouTube easily, CNN's undecided voter panels. They just don't know what they're going to do. But 10 minutes later, they all miraculously decide that they're going to vote for Biden by a show of hands. There's also been some instances of people showing up in more than one place. Like, here's Greg. He's an undecided. This is easier for them now, where everyone at these undecided voter events and interviews has to wear masks. But one dude definitely showed up at two different places, I think, is two different people. So the other thing that we need to defend against, too, is the appeals to authority, right? Which we talked about a little bit, used as a narrative tool in War of the Worlds. People were completely defenseless against it there, obviously, certainly once they started to buy into this. But we see this on the news all the time, and we probably engage in it ourselves, right? Like we bring on people who are experts. And it is like challenging to go up, like if you have a podcast and you have a view of, you know, some social issue, political issue, educational issue, economic, you are going to gravitate more towards the people that confirm your beliefs, you know, even as a podcaster who rails against the appeals to authority all the time. But, you know, this was the cry that we've been hearing on the mainstream news, I would say, for the last, 8 months now, is trust the experts, listen to the experts who have been wrong about a lot of things, maybe even most key things at this point, and have also flip-flopped on those things, but it is still the cry.
Mm-hmm. So in War of the Worlds, they rely heavily on appeals to authority. They have interviews with professors. They have interviews with high-ranking military and militiamen. They have interviews with members of Washington, all within the first half hour. And it's breaking news. Our reporter is here with Professor So-and-so. Breaking news. We've got a feet-on-the-ground report with high-ranking military general of the militia of New Jersey talking about this, or Senator so-and-so from Washington just said. And so they, I think back then, back in the 1930s, the appeal to authority was probably a lot more powerful than it is now. People are more skeptical of politicians, for one. I mean, it's commonplace knowledge that politicians are liars. Most people don't trust the media like they used to. Most people don't trust someone in a uniform just because they're in a uniform. Most people don't blindly trust their doctors the way that they used to. But that being said, if someone's on the fence, if someone's already prone to buy, whether it's your idea, your product, your service, adding somebody with a lab coat will help push them over the fence. Adding somebody with an official looking name badge on their chest will help push somebody over the fence. Saying so-and-so is a professor or a PhD of whatever science, and they say that you need to do this, will help push someone who's on the fence and wanting to go that way already. So the appeal to authority still works. It's still utilized. I don't think it's as powerful now, but I mean, we still have those. I'm not a doctor, but I play one on commercials selling hemorrhoid medicine. So it does still work for people that are on the fence and wanting to lean over to your side.
Right. So whether it's just like stock footage of guy in a lab coat or interview with doctor, I think there is, and this is especially true with television, there's something like the magic of the medium that seduced people our age, certainly people our parents' age, where it's like, if this person was not highly qualified, how the hell could they have gotten onto the other side of this screen? You know, with television, film, television, radio, these things up until the advent of YouTube and podcasting were so exclusionary that if you could make it to the side that projects out into somebody's living room, you had to be a serious and trustworthy person. And if you go back and you look at examples of that, yeah, the further you go back, the more transparent it becomes. But it's still being used all the time. I mean, a 16-year-old girl was passed off as an expert on coronavirus on CNN just like 4 or 5 months ago. So it's definitely still happening because she had, you know, built that I don't want to say no, like, and trust with Greta Thunberg, but as far as CNN and a lot of their viewers were concerned, she had. So there she was. But as we move into talking about, like, the truth of this whole thing, the truth of the impact of the War of the Worlds broadcast, I think one other thing that's worth pointing out, I think a lot of people in the audience already know this, but it's certainly worth highlighting here, is you can tell whatever story you want by just the careful assembly of the right selective examples. We recently in those university discussion groups that I run, which are, again, very focused on, like, critical thinking, media literacy, we did this analysis of this New York Times video series about Russian disinformation. And the New York Times put this together, and they tell a very convincing story about how Russian disinformation is run by Putin to help Trump, which I don't think is true. But in order to do that, they have an assembly of almost entirely true information. And then they just take that true information, they exclude what would break away or challenge the narrative they want to present. They exclude that. And then they just kind of point you at this conclusion that they actually started out with. So it's not like, you know, we'll see what's out there. We'll gather all the evidence. We'll make a decision about what this is. We'll build the conclusion out of the evidence that we find. What they do is they say, here's the conclusion we want to present. Go find the evidence and selectively remove whatever doesn't fit. So this is true with even the smallest news package. My friend Osborne, who used to be on the show, he said, you'll know how fake the news is once you're the subject of a news story. Right? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that that actually leads nicely into what the truth is behind the whole panic of War of the Worlds, right?
Yeah, and a couple things to add to that. I think that's kind of like a lying by omission fallacy.
Yeah.
It's what I think of is like the statistic, 1 out of 3 homeless people are women. Homelessness is a woman's issue.
Yeah.
Okay, well, what about the other 2 out of 3 people? Like, you pick which part of the story you want to focus on in order to make that the story. That is very much something that we deal with a lot in modern day. You mentioned the Hunter Biden laptop earlier. Mm-hmm. I was talking with one of my friends who had never even heard, didn't even know any of this stuff. It's 2 weeks now since that was released, and every day more and more of the video and messages that are on it are slowly being leaked out. And he told me he hadn't even heard of the laptop. He hadn't even heard of the stuff that was on there. And I'm like, seriously? And it's weird for me because I thought everybody knew about this stuff, but he watches MSNBC and CNN exclusively. Yes, I do have friends that watch MSNBC and CNN exclusively. Mm-hmm. And he hadn't heard of any of it. And he's diehard, going to vote for Biden because I need to save America from Trump.
Was he incredulous when you told him about it? Was he like, no, that's bullshit, or that can't be true?
His first response was, well, what about Don Jr. having deals with whatever? And I was just like, okay, well, if Don Jr. was also caught smoking crack with prostitutes and also caught sending nudes to his 14-year-old niece and also caught doing this, this, and this, you might have a point. And he goes, I haven't heard of Hunter Biden doing any of that stuff. I said, well, that's because your news picks and chooses. And to be fair, Fox News does the same stuff. Fox News will run defense for the people that they like, and they'll
sure
exclude parts of the stories that don't fit the narrative that their viewers want to. So I feel like it's not an exclusive problem to one party or the other, but it does happen. And personally, I get most of my news from YouTube and that, or from a BitChute. And then I do my investigating from there, because those sources tend to be the people that I watch there. They tend to be less one way or the other, and they tend to be more willing to talk about things, even if they disrupt one narrative or the other. And then I can go and say, oh, okay, this new thing happened. If I want to know more about it, I can go and look. But a lot of times the stuff that's being talked about on YouTube or the stuff that's being talked about on BitChute, regardless of the validity of it, it won't even be mentioned. Like the New York Post story just got completely censored everywhere except for New York Post.
Yeah, so this dark curiosity took me to like Sacha Baron Cohen's recent media appearances. This new Borat 2 film just came out, right? And Rudy Giuliani appears in the film. So there's been this major attack on Rudy Giuliani for the last couple weeks. And I'm watching him do this interview where they're talking about it, now the story, if anybody doesn't know, and God bless you if you don't know, I envy you. In the film, there's an actress in her 20s playing Borat's 15-year-old daughter who presents herself to Rudy Giuliani as a 20-something-year-old reporter, and they wind up in a hotel room, and it's a little bit sketchy. I haven't seen the scene yet, but I'm told that it's like not as bad as the media made it out to be. So now there are people who are actually copying and pasting this Rudy Giuliani goes to a hotel room with a 15-year-old girl. And Sacha Baron Cohen is going around giving interviews saying, oh, like, oh, yeah, Rudy Giuliani, it's terrible. And these are the kind of people that Trump, you know, surrounds himself with because, you know, he's friends with Jeffrey Epstein. So here we see they're attacking the man who was kind of behind this whole Hunter Biden laptop scandal. But that's not even being mentioned. Right. So they don't, it's not even clear to the audience like why they're attacking this guy. And I felt so bad for the people who don't even understand the whole dialectic that's going on here. Dialectic's a strong word for what this is, but like they're missing all these pieces of like all this conflict that's going on. And it's sad, it's frustrating, and it's a little bit scary. And I don't want to make a false equivalency between like that kind of stuff and Fox News, because while Fox News is very popular, the preponderance of just media control on the left is so much larger right now. And that's a little bit scary. But yeah, and that takes us back to the truth of the event. Mm-hmm.
So I think we've kind of covered a couple of different aspects of how you can get some of the marketing lessons you can get out of War of the Worlds. We've also kind of talked about some of the precautions you should take when it comes to consuming media. We talked about the panic that it caused, or the hoax about the panic that it caused. And you kind of hinted at this, that maybe there wasn't actually a panic. It was maybe something else going on. I think the truth of it is, and this is from, obviously I wasn't alive during 1938, so I wasn't there, but from what I can tell, there wasn't a major panic as it's been presented. I think that there was a few 911 calls placed specifically in New Jersey, people being like, hey, we're listening to this, but we're looking outside and we're not seeing it. Is this a hoax? What's going on here? Have you gotten any calls? Is this real? Is this legitimate? Or is this just a play on the radio? I'm not very sure. I think that was pretty much the extent of it. I don't think that there was really a nationwide panic. But you mentioned it was a new media.
Mm-hmm.
And the newspapers, the myth was really perpetuated by the newspapers. After the event, the newspapers came out and said, oh, look at this unregulated radio. It's spreading fake news. It's causing a panic. People don't know what's real and what's not real. They need the trusted fact checkers of the newspapers. And I think it was a situation of radio was kind of like the Wild West of media at the time. They didn't have as much regulations because they weren't as established as the newspapers were. And therefore, since they were less regulated, they were more of a threat and they were major competition, but they were competition that weren't wearing the same shackles. So the newspapers are running a race with their shoelaces tied together, and the radio is running the same race and their shoelaces aren't tied together. And the newspapers were like, oh, well, look how dangerous it is to not have the radio also have their shoelaces tied together. It's not fair. It's dangerous. It's a threat to the public. Look at the panic that War of the Worlds caused.
Right. So the very next day on the cover of the New York Daily News, the big headline is fake war on radio spreads panic over U.S., right? And then there's like these little human interest story, smaller headlines that like woman tries suicide, man wants to fight Mars, college boys faint. Some things never change, I guess. Where is it safe, right? Some things really never change, I guess. But then the side story under the main story is Senator Mapp's bill to censor airwaves. Like the next day, they were ready to go with that. Yeah, to that, there was, I guess, a kind of predecessor to the Nielsen ratings. It was called CB Hooper. And they, during the broadcast, called like 5,000 homes, and less than 2% of it were 2% of the people who answered their phone were watching or listening to, War of the Worlds. Now, I guess some of them could have already run out of their house or gone into a bomb shelter. But yeah, you're absolutely right that, you know, I think two forms of media screwed with the public here, right? Because the one you already said is like, radio is a threat. The established media, the newspaper, is going to say that radio is a threat. Look at the threat of radio. Radio embraces it. They say, look at the power of radio. Come buy ads here, you know, like advertise with us. Look, we induced a mass panic. And, you know, I think the survival of the myth comes down to what form of media did people trust more at the time? And the answer was the newspaper. You think of things like fears, beliefs, prejudices. People are more likely to go to what's going to confirm their biases, even with a flimsy presentation. The pockets of hysteria or the individual occurrences of hysteria could have been real, but they were just sort of mashed into this presentation to make it look like, if you look at the cover of the newspaper the next day, you'd think this was the rule for the entire country. And it certainly wasn't true at all.
Well, and that's the thing to pay attention to is 99,000 people listened to this and went about their day and said, well, that's interesting. Oh, that was entertaining. Mm-hmm. That was the story.
Yeah.
99,000 people listened to this and didn't react irrationally whatsoever. The newspaper says, man wants to fight Mars. Woman commits suicide. Radio must be regulated.
Yep.
So the trusted newspaper completely distorts the truth to attack the dangerous, non-fact-checked radio, which is exactly what we have today with social media versus mainstream media, YouTube versus CNN, mm-hmm. YouTube versus Fox News. They smear PewDiePie's a racist and said the N-word on a stream, or so-and-so is platforming hate speech or whatever, whatever. Alex Jones said that they're turning the frogs gay and he needs to be fact-checked. You can't trust alternative media, says the mainstream media that completely distorts and lies about alternative media and censors things that alternative media is willing to cover. So it's the regulated liars accusing the unregulated, maybe fibbers, of needing to be regulated because they're liars.
Yep. And the politicians jumped on that too, actually. I remember Dianne Feinstein like 5 years ago talking about the bona fides that real journalists have versus all of these upstarts who just think they can go and report the news. So there were places in Washington, and I'm sure, you know, other state and local governments would have loved to be able to do this as well, that were having serious conversations about how they could deny access to these fake journalists, people who thought they were reporters just because they had a blog or a YouTube channel, but hadn't been, you know, given government approval to be a real serious like White House correspondent. You know, there's another interesting side note to this whole story. So 1938, we talk about what the newspaper looks like on Halloween Day the very next morning. Orson Welles, a young man, finds himself surrounded by reporters, and people can go and you can watch this footage, Halloween Day, and they're all scolding him. Obviously, this news story needs an antagonist.
I can't imagine. I mean, you must realize that when I left the broadcast last night, I went into a dress rehearsal for a play that's opening in 2 days, and I've had almost no sleep, and I know less about this than you do. I haven't read the papers except actually.
At the time you were giving this role, were you aware the terror was going on throughout the nation?
Oh, no, of course not. We did Dracula, and it seemed to me during Dracula I had high hopes that people would react as they do in a movie of that kind, and I don't know that they did particularly, and so I've given up. One doesn't believe in the radio audience much. You don't know that whether they're listening or not. You have no idea how many people are listening and what they're thinking. I had every hope that that the people would be excited as they would be at a melodrama.
Do you think, Mr. Welles, that you might have taken unfair advantage of the public in using a method as a conveyance for authentic news?
I don't believe that I have since It is not a method original with me. It is used by many radio programs. I am terribly shocked by the effect it's had. I do not believe that the method is original with me.
So you can watch him, like, defend himself. You know, he's saying things like, I haven't seen anything. You know more than I do. I've been up all night preparing for a play that opens in a couple of days. I never thought this would be the case. But it's just, all of these scolds from the newspaper. How dare you do this? What a terrible thing to do. Well, 3 years later, Orson Welles puts out a movie about probably the greatest or most significant, in many ways, one of the most negatively impactful yellow journalists, William Randolph Hearst. Disguised in the film, of course, as Charles Foster Kane. Mm-hmm. I wonder, I don't know the answer, but how much of the antagonism that Welles, who also wrote, directed, I mean, he was a total auteur with this movie. He did almost everything with Citizen Kane, including starring in it. How much of that antagonism that he put into the movie came from this event? And it didn't end there, because Hearst, who was still alive at the time, Hearst had been doing this like muckraking yellow journalism for 40 years at least at that point, and was involved in all other kinds of nasty political things as well. One of the stories was he sent an underage girl.
Hearst, you see, launched such an attack on us, particularly on me. Or his minions did. It was kind of, can no man rid me of this, and so on. And I was once, this would get terribly long and anecdotal, but I'll try to tell it very quickly. I was lecturing in Buffalo. And after the lecture, I was with some people having dinner. And a waiter said, there's a policeman wants to see you. And I turned white. I always feel guilty when policemen want to see me. And the cop turned out to be very nice. He said, don't go back to your hotel room. I said, why? And he said, they've got an underage girl, undressed, and photographers waiting for you. It's a setup. So I didn't go back to my room that night. I just stayed up, took the plane in the morning. But that was as far as they were prepared to go. I would have gone to jail, of course. And they had the producers in Hollywood ready all together to pay RKO to burn the negative. It was nip and tuck, you know, whether the negative would be burnt, the picture never shown.
Yeah, this is just one chapter in the interesting antagonism between Orson Welles and the newspaper world.
That's crazy, because that story right there is very reminiscent of the Rudy Giuliani story. It's just like the same thing playing out over and over again.
Well, is there any closing thoughts or any stone we left unturned in this conversation?
Yeah, I just want to, I guess, close with, people trust media. And whether it's the panic or whether it's the myth of the panic, whatever it is that people wanted to believe, if there was a media there ready to instate those beliefs, they were going to get believed.
Yeah.
And if something is presented as news, a lot of times people will believe what they see on the news over what they see with their own eyes. They'll hear about bodies being piled up and they'll look outside and they won't see anything that looks even remotely close to it, but the news told them, so they've got to be afraid of it.
Yeah.
They'll hear about threats from this color of person or threats from that color of person. And they know people of that same color, those same religions, and they're nothing like what their news presents them, but they believe their news over their own senses. It's that whole, who are you going to believe, me or your own lying eyes? A lot of times, if me is the media, people are going to believe the media. And so my disclaimer, as always, I don't work with the way I wish people were. I don't work with the way I wish the world was. My job is not to live in the world of I wish. My job is to live in the world of how things are and work with that. This is how people are. And so as a business owner, as a marketer, don't ignore the power that media has over people. Don't ignore the power that things presented as news, things presented as content can have over people. And as a marketer, one of the most effective things for me is to use my content as media, as a bridge from what people currently believe to what I need them to believe. They're just about to buy my thing, my product, my service, whatever it is. But the reason that they haven't yet is because they currently believe it's a great thing, but it won't work for me. Or it sounds great, but people who have made this promise before have been snake oil salesmen. Or it's a great thing, but my wife wouldn't understand, or my coworkers wouldn't understand. That's what they believe. That's what is holding them back. And I know what they need to believe. They need to believe it's a great thing and it will work for me. It's a great thing and my wife will understand. It's a great thing and my boss will applaud me for doing this. What they believe and what they need to believe in order to take action, I need to use my content as a media, as a bridge from what they believe to what they need to believe. And so as a business owner, as a marketer, don't hide from the power of media. Don't shame the power of media, or don't say, well, media is manipulative and so I'm just not going to use it. Understand, it's a bridge. It gets people from where they're currently at to where you need them to be at in order to take the action that you want them to take. And when you're creating media, when you're creating content, don't just do it blindly to entertain, to inspire, to educate. Do it with the intention of, this is where they're at. This belief system is what's preventing them from taking the action. How do I use my media as a bridge to get them to what they need to believe in order to take action? And again, this can be used for nefarious reasons, for nefarious purposes. The media uses it all the time. Snake oil salesmen will use it for ill ends. I'm going to trust that you won't, that you'll only use it to sell people on things that you actually believe in, but don't shy away from it. And that is the main point that I wanted to get across with this episode.
Absolutely. Well, we both have very smart audiences in what we do. And I assume that a lot of people who are listening to this have pretty good intellectual self-defenses, but they know people who don't, right? And I think this is a really good show, considering we talked before, and we're going to put this one out for free as well, because it's an important subject. This is a good show to pass along. The first and the third episode of Professional Manipulators for Hire are available on our sites for free. So please pass them along to people you think might benefit from seeing how things are done behind the scenes to manipulate them. And I just appreciate everybody who does listen to this, who has worked to, you know, learn things like logic and logical fallacies and improve their media and information literacy. Thank you for taking the time to revisit some of these things with us as well. It's greatly appreciated. Thanks, Nathan.
Thank you, Brett. I appreciate your time as well.
Nice. We did it.
My life's a culmination of my past achievements, with a lot of heavy lifting, a lot of deep breathing, a lot of courage, a lot of doubts, a lot of mixed feelings, a lot of love, a lot of luggage for a lot of reasons. I ain't forgot about the pain and all the mistreatment. I ain't forgot the little wax they tried to wiggle me in. I ain't forgot about the flower deep underneath the crowded streets, sprouting in between the cracks, steaming, shouting, baby. Follow like a lion in the Coliseum, and you can positive, I think I'm in the mausoleum. You think I'll ever hang it up on money? Stop dreaming. You think I'll ever stop, oh baby, now you're reaching. I won't stop till I feel my lungs stop breathing. I won't stop till I feel my heart stop beating. I won't stop speaking this week and next week and all fall steep singing. I don't stop singing. Fire freezing, ice heating, fire palms beating all fat fall free, clear from the mountaintop screaming. Baby, calling out to all area group, we gon' make this shit happen right here, right now. Calling out to all area group, we gon' make this shit happen right here, right now. I said, calling out to all area group, we gon' make this shit happen right here, right now. Call it out to all area group, we gon' make this shit happen right here, right now.
People, are you ready? Let's start the show.
Get it on, get it on. We about to get it on, get it on. Getting it on, on, and on.
Don't worry about the president. He can't stop
I said, get it on, get it on. We about to get it on, get it on.